This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, charter schools are now operating virtual classrooms that exist only on the Internet, drawing money from public school budgets. But only about half of these virtual students graduate. And rich people and criminals are extracting trillions of dollars from developing countries, most of which winds up in banks in the United States and Western Europe.
But first, Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein took her cause to the annual Left Forum conference in New York City. Stein and her party still have to contend with Democrats who claim third parties are spoilers that only help the Republicans.
People say to me sometimes, so you're okay with getting Trump elected? And I say, I will be horrified if Donald Trump gets elected, and I will be horrified if Hillary Clinton gets elected, and I am most horrified by a political system that gives us two lethal choices and says, pick between them and that's it. And the good news, you know, is that this is really what the American people have really rejected. That rejection has been growing, and it has really reached critical proportions. And it's not just Bernie Sanders who's bringing the system down, or Donald Trump. They are really reflections of the inherent dysfunction of this system, and the fact that the House of Cards really is coming down, and the sooner that happens, the better. And as Chris was saying, it's like a house that has been eaten out from the inside by termites, and it's just waiting to collapse now. Polls have shown for quite some time that voters have rejected both of these parties, have been clamoring for an independent third party or parties, and a most recent poll by the Wall Street Journal showed that Republicans are now 21% of the electorate, Democrats are 29%, so they're both minority parties, and 50% have actually divorced both of those parties. So this is a system that's really been waiting to collapse, and for a variety of reasons, you know, Sanders and Donald Trump have really forced the issue, and it's really important that we seize this moment. The clock is ticking. This is kind of the Hail Mary moment. It's now or never. In many ways, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, just came out with a report last week. What the organization said, it was one of their senior scientists talking at a conference of the insurance industry, and what she said was they had just received an oh my God report from the West Antarctic ice sheet, confirming what Jim Hansen said about a year ago, but moving up the timetable, so that we could expect about 9 feet of sea level rise by 2050 if we haven't taken fundamentally, you know, profoundly different action by then. But what is it that is happening under even the Democratic White House with two Democratic houses of Congress? You know, we got all of the above, which was basically drill, baby, drill on steroids if you actually look at what happened. Yes, they increased renewable energy, and that's great, but nature doesn't know about renewable energy. Nature knows about fossil fuels and the poison that carbon emissions and methane create. And in fact, the report also just released last week showed that not only are these emissions continuing to go up, but they are accelerating at the rate that they are going up. And even while the agreement in Paris was being forged, this agreement for which there was a lot of hot air and celebration, no pun intended, about the hot air in Paris. Even at the same time that Obama and company were celebrating this agreement, they were behind closed doors signing on to the end of the oil export ban, which basically massively increases fossil fuel excavation in the U.S. And under all of the above, we rep pipeline around the world. Remember, Obama was bragging about that in the 2012 election. So the point is, we've got two corporate parties here. Neither of them is going to save us. One is kind of the corporate vision with a smile, and the other is a corporate vision, shall we say, without a smile. And they are funded by the same predatory banks, fossil fuel giants, and war profiteers, and insurance companies. So that's what we get with more or less kind of public relations trappings around them. It's really clear that we can't keep going in this direction, because we are only accelerating, whether you are looking at the climate meltdown, which is now, it's now got a deadline, and that's within the lifetimes of many people in this room. 2050, half of Manhattan will be underwater, and not only half of Manhattan, but all of the coast, and all of the population centers around the coast, not just of the U.S., but around the world, and that means about 600 million people are refugees. We think we have a problem right now handling the 40 million refugees fleeing from other consequences of misguided corporate U.S. military and economic policies, poverty and war, basically, thanks to our war machines and our, you know, and our economic domination and free trade agreements and things like that. You know, we are not going to survive this hit unless we resolve to change that right now. The greater evil right here, you know, is this meltdown we are looking at, not only of the climate, but also of our economy, because the Dodd-Frank bill did not fix that. The banks are bigger than ever, more predatory than ever, more prone to fail than ever, and look at the war effort and the drones and the assault on our civil liberties under a Democratic Party with two Democratic houses of Congress. It's really important to stand up and to recognize that propaganda campaign for what it is. It is a self-serving propaganda campaign used by the Democrats to basically maintain their stranglehold on power. It's important to recognize that we actually have the power. In the words of Alice Walker, the biggest way people give up power is by not knowing we have it to start with. If you take one group alone that has no place to go except into a green campaign, and of course I want to agree with both of our previous eminent speakers that political parties are really, in my view, they are the megaphone for the social movements. Yes. The real work, the real engine of change here is the social movements, of course. But if we don't also fight in the halls of power, we're basically raising the white flag of surrender. And we will be bulldozed, you know, with the stroke of a pen based on policies that are delivered by those two political predators. So we must stand up, and the great news is that we can stand up, and we actually have the power to stand up. If you took only the number of people who are locked into predatory student loan debt, something we don't hear enough about, but it is an absolute life-changing issue for an entire generation and more, who are basically locked into economic servitude for the rest of their lives without hope of getting out, given what the economy is, in this state of Wall Street domination. And those people are 43 million. That is a winning plurality in a presidential race. And there's only one campaign they can go to, which will bail them out like we bailed out the bankers who crashed the economy. It's about time to bail out the victims of that waste, fraud, and abuse. If that word were to get out, you know, it doesn't take a whole lot of motivation for people to recognize they can cancel that debt, basically, with a stroke of a pen. Come out and vote green in 2016, and friends don't let friends stay home in debt. We could see this very crazy election get a whole lot crazier very quickly. Let me just mention another thing that could make the election get a whole lot crazier very quickly. We are right now in the polls where Bernie Sanders was about 6 months ago. So don't for a minute accept the propaganda that we are powerless, that we are irrelevant to this process and this discussion. As Bernie's campaign begins to fold, which in some sense it already is, the writing is very clear where it's going. As it continues down that path, basically a path of sabotage, because the Democrats have been waiting for a moment to ambush Bernie. What we're seeing going on with Nevada is the Dean scream of 2016. This is a concocted ambush that was just waiting for the right moment. This is what the Democrats always do. This is why we cannot have a revolutionary campaign in a counter-revolutionary party. We are seeing play out. Why it is that we must build this party. But the bottom line is, we need to stand up. We need to stand up now. This is the Hail Mary moment. It's now or never. If we really want to decommission those nuclear power plants along the coast, and there are about 24 of them that will create Fukushimas, if we do not begin to act right now, they are going to flood out. They are at sea level. And this is not an academic issue. This is not a discretionary issue. This makes all other propaganda look very small. When they start talking about Supreme Court appointments, we should be telling the Supreme Court what to do. That's what we did back in the 1960s in getting women's right to choose through the Supreme Court, because we had a very active and powerful movement. We also told Nixon what to do back in the 1960s, one of the worst, most oppressive presidents ever. We told him what to do. We brought the troops home from Vietnam. We created the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and protected workers in the workplace with OSHA. So don't for a minute accept this propaganda that we are powerless. We are powerful. And the minute we flip that switch in our own minds from powerless to powerful, we'll discover that we actually have the numbers that it takes to win this battle. We have the values, we have the visions, we have programmatic solutions. The missing ingredient here is the courage of our own convictions to stand up and be the dominant force that we can be right now. And whether we win the White House and turn it into a greenhouse, or we simply help elevate this political battle as part of the social battle, this is what we do. The attitude of cowardice that we are being told to accept when we're told vote for the lesser evil, we're being told be cowards in the voting booth. If you're a coward in the voting booth, it's hard to have courage out in the street. We need to have courage everywhere. Final comment. It's time to forget the lesser evil and fight for the greater good, like our lives depend on it, because they do. We have the power to put people, planet, and peace over profit, and the power to do that is not just in our hopes and our dreams. It's right here and right now in our hands. Thank you very much.
That was Jill Stein of the Green Party at the Left Forum Conference in New York City. Black Agenda Report executive editor Glenn Ford appeared on the same panel with Dr. Stein. The event was titled, Can Bernie Sanders Build Left and Black Power? Ford said Sanders is a Franklin Roosevelt New Deal type politician who thinks the bankers are necessary to society. So Sanders doesn't really want to hurt the bankers too much. Most importantly, said Ford, Sanders is a Democrat.
Bernie Sanders does not hate their corporate party, which is the Democratic Party as well as the Republican Party, because that's who he is. He is a Democrat. He is a ranking Democrat with seniority. And he doesn't hate the corporate electoral duopoly either. He's made it known over the years that he doesn't like third parties. He wants to reform the Democratic Party from within. And he wants a better kind of banker, a nicer banker, a friendlier banker, a more patriotic banker who wouldn't send all the jobs and the money to the global South. But beyond that, Bernie Sanders doesn't appear to have much of a problem with the bankers and the corporations' depredations all over the world, especially in the global South. He doesn't seem to have a problem with this huge American military, which protects the rights of the corporations and the bankers to oppress the folks all over the world, especially in the global south. And he doesn't question the need for this humongous U.S. military, which is more expensive than all the other militaries of the world combined. Sanders does say that he would like the United States to lay off excessive regime change. But what does he understand about regime change? What does he think this huge military is about except to intimidate the rest of the world? So, no, a man like Bernie Sanders does not want to build a kind of socialism that any real socialist would recognize. And he does not want to dismantle imperialism. That's not his job, and that's not his mission, and he will not accept that kind of mission. He doesn't want a permanent alternative to the left of the Democratic Party. And he won't risk throwing the election to Trump or throwing the election to any Republican. And if somehow he did accept a third party assignment, I would not trust Bernie Sanders for a second to fulfill faithfully his obligation and his promise. So Bernie Sanders, the man, is not the answer to building the left. And certainly he is not the answer to building black power. He does not want to make left Democrats become members of some other party. He wants to strengthen the leftish faction within the Democratic Party. That is his mission. Nevertheless, and this is the big nevertheless, his candidacy has been of enormous benefit to the prospects of breaking up the electoral duopoly in the United States. That has been the effect of the Bernie Sanders candidacy. It was not Bernie Sanders' mission in getting into the presidential race, not his mission to create a third party or a left party or any kind of party outside of the Democratic Party. And I don't think that he will allow himself to be drafted into that mission. I think that he will perform his duty as a sheepdog to the bitter end, and then he will fold. But many millions of his supporters will seek an alternative party, to the left of the Democratic Party as headed by Hillary Clinton. I call that the DLC Democratic Party. They'll seek to find and they'll try to build a broad social democratic party. And I'm using that term as meaning folks who are left liberal. I'm using it in a U.S. Sense because the U.S. has never had a social democratic party, so you got to start describing it at some point. They'll seek to build that kind of party, the kind of party that Bernie Sanders likes to talk about, a Scandinavian social democratic kind of party. However, and this is one of the great ironies or maybe jokes of history, the way history is going to go, I think, Bernie Sanders is not going to be in that party. His candidacy will have crystallized a demand for such a party, but he will not build that party. Jill Stein is a social democrat. Some people who are Marxists say that as a pejorative. They spit it out, a social democrat. But I'm not spitting it out. She's a good social democrat. She is a left social democrat in the United States sense. Her party brand and, of course, its ballot lines are in demand. And that is as a direct result of the crystallization of thinking around an alternative left of the Democratic Party. But Bernie doesn't return Green Party phone calls, and he doesn't do that for all the reasons that I've just been talking about. However, Bernie Sanders has wittingly or unwittingly contributed hugely to the crisis in the duopoly system. So we have to say, I have to say, thank you very much, Bernie Sanders. But if we're going to go around thanking and giving credit to Bernie Sanders, then you have to give credit to Donald Trump. Nobody's clapping for Donald Trump. You like the damage that Bernie Sanders does to the duopoly, but you don't give Donald Trump any credit at all. But he'll give himself credit. Because if the duopoly is the immediate enemy, and I think that is the case, then Donald Trump has already done more damage to the duopoly than Bernie Sanders has so far. Trump has at least temporarily wrecked the Republicans. He has distilled the raw white supremacist appeal of a party that for about 50 years has been the white man's party in the United States. He has distilled it down to its essence without all these corporate trappings. And in the process, he has stripped away most of the economic program and the imperial military rationale that is the real agenda of the corporate Republican elite, which is why they are so upset, which is why there is such a crisis within the institutional party. That's why these elites, these corporate masters, have withdrawn their money, and that's why they will tacitly or actively support Hillary Clinton, who, in Paul Street's words, makes the Democrats, or wants to make the Democrats, the truer and more fully explicit ruling class party in this country. The Trump stewardship of the Republican Party may be temporary. We don't know. The old owners of that party may get their party back, but the tens of millions of hardcore white nationalist Trump supporters who have rallied to that guy now see themselves as a distinct social force in the country. And they are going to have their own party. It may not be the Republican Party, but they're going to have their own party. That's the kind of damage that has already been done to the duopoly. Donald Trump has already destabilized one half of the duopoly, which puts the whole system in distress and makes the Democratic split damn near inevitable at some point in the near future, because these two systems, these two poles of the system are interconnected. That's because the Republican split mandates that Hillary Clinton make a very, very sharp right turn this electoral season in order to scoop up all the hundreds of millions of dollars that would have gone, I'm talking about corporate money, would have gone to the Republicans, and to absorb the millions of Republican voters that cannot stomach Trump. The definition of a moderate Republican is going to change for the Democratic Party. A moderate becomes anybody in the Republican Party who can't stand Trump. Hillary sees an historic opportunity to build a big tent Democratic Party that sits on the entire U.S. political spectrum, minus Trump's fervent white nationalists and people like we have in this room. But the Democratic Party, in her vision, would sit on all the rest, rendering everyone to her left in that party inert and irrelevant. The corporations, of course, would remain in charge. That's her vision, and she is chomping at the bit to begin making that national kind of statement, that big tent appeal to the country. The Sanders folks, by their refusal to give up and roll over, are frustrating Hillary Clinton's efforts to make the pivot to the right. And she is very likely to lose her discipline and further lash out at the Sanders people. And that will be just fine, because that will make them, the Sanders people, more angry, and they might really make that decisive exit from the party, and that will happen no matter what Bernie Sanders does. I'm told I only have like 0 seconds left. Can I get 2 seconds? And that 2 minutes is so we can get to the black part of the question. And the black part of the question is, Sanders the answer to building black power? And it's hard to say that with a straight face. Here's the situation. Black people are not going to withdraw from the Democratic Party in large numbers until the duopoly is demonstrably, that is to their satisfaction, cracked, till they can see the fracture, till the duopoly is diminished. The duopoly is, of course, a trap for everybody, but it is a double trap for black people. It is a trap within a trap for blacks because of the profoundly racist nature of U.S. society. The two parties, of course, are both controlled by corporations, but one of those parties throughout U.S. history and dating back before emancipation, one of those parties was always the white man's party. And for the last half century, that's been the Republican Party. The masses of black people cannot be in the white man's party. So they're trapped in the Democratic Party. That's the trap. But there is the trap within the trap. And that is, because the rationale for being a Democrat, for black people being weighted into the Democratic Party, moves black folks to support the Democratic primary candidate that they perceive to be the one that has the strongest chance of beating the Republicans, of beating the white man's party. That's why you're a Democrat, to beat the Republicans. Their own politics are secondary in the process of making the decision. Who is going to be the strongest candidate against the Republicans is absolutely number one. And so we get this insane situation that we have, in which the most left-wing constituency in the country supports the right wing of the Democratic Party that they are trapped inside of. In other words, the critical black bloc in the Democratic Party most closely resembles that Scandinavian Social Democratic Party that Bernie likes to talk to. And lots of black folks are much further to the left than that Social Democratic model. But they stay inside the party and at the right side of the party in fear of the triumph of the white man's party, the Republicans. And in order to break this double trap, we need a fracturing of the Republicans so that they no longer are perceived as a kind of monolithic threat. And we also need real social democrats in their own party to create space that black people can go to.
That was Bar Executive Editor Glenn Ford. Charter school companies are now operating so-called virtual schools that have no classrooms or buildings, but only exist on the internet. However, the charter operators are paid public money for each student, just like conventional public schools. David Cohen is executive director of the advocacy group In the Public Interest. He says an outfit called California Virtual Academies graduates less than half of its students and is accused of inflating its online attendance to collect thousands of dollars from the state. According to the San Jose Mercury newspaper, the virtual academies count students as present if they log on for as little as 1 minute during the school day. David Cohen says the online charter is run by a for-profit company called K-12 Inc.
K-12 Inc. is the largest national online charter school for-profit company. They call them online charter schools, they call them cyber schools, and it's like homeschooling, essentially, for people who sit in front of a computer, but have teachers. There are, you know, employees who teach, who work for K-12 Inc., who are responsible for teaching all the students. It's worth describing how it works a little bit, at least in California, because it may be slightly different in other states. In California, the virtual charter schools, each of the schools, are actually nonprofits. because California law requires that charter schools be nonprofits. The nonprofits can then hire anybody they want, including a for-profit like K-12 Inc., to run the school. And they're basically a contractor to the nonprofit board. The way it really works is K-12 goes and identifies a school, recruits some folks to form a nonprofit, who then hire them. So it's really K-12 Inc.'s schools, but there's a legal construct that they created that they claim that it's not us, it's the board. But they're in complete control.
Now, in terms of who organizes the school and asks for the charter, you say that actually employees of K-12 represent themselves as parents and then start this process along. Here's what it says in your report. Records show that the company's employees launched each of K-12 Inc.'s 17 online schools in California, although the applications they filed to open those schools described the founders as a group of parents.
Yes, employees of K-12 Inc. go and say they're parents, and they probably are for all we know, and form the charter. And that's what I mean about this is it's not fraud because it's legal how it works. K-12 Inc. is forming schools, nonprofit schools, that are by law independent, but in reality, that's a joke.
One of your main complaints about K-12's operations is that students need login, it appears, maybe for just 1 minute, and yet they're counted as present.
That's right. The way school funding works is the school, whatever school it is, public or private or charter, gets a daily amount for each student in attendance. And so it's in all of our interest to have kids at school. It's in K-12's financial interest to have kids at school. And because it's an online charter, their policy is if they sign in for a minute, we'll count them as attending that day and they'll get their full daily attendance quota. They do it a lot. What they do is they push numbers of students that are enrolled. They reduce costs by having teachers deal with students not a lot of time, unfortunately, and they also push tons of administrative work on teachers, so even if they want to and figure out ways to spend more time with students, they're burdened with a huge amount of administrative work because K-12 Inc. understaffs their admin.
And in fact, these teachers are being paid not much more than $30,000 a year in a state whose teachers usually make about twice that much in public institutions.
You know, in some levels, it's not that complicated. A for-profit wants to run schools, but they also need to make a profit. They also need to pay their CEO. They also need to do whatever they need to do for shareholders on the stock exchange. And so that money's got to come from somewhere. So it comes from paying teachers less, hiring fewer administrative people, squeezing in every way they can. It's not that complicated.
And this is where much of the charter school industry makes its money, although many of the schools in many states and many systems are non-for-profit, they contract out to these for-profit corporations which operate all over the country, and that's where the private dollars are siphoned from the public system.
That's exactly right. They're called education management organizations. That's the for-profits that will say, we'll run your school for you, because lots of states, like California, lots of states require they be nonprofit technically, and then some nonprofits create a school, but then they don't know how to do it. So you have national companies, in some case regional, or that do multiple states and not throughout the country, who need to make a profit. And all of the dollars to educate children's charters are public dollars that could be going to public schools. So if you take the same dollars and put it in a charter school that a public school gets, and then you have to add on other expenditures like profits and marketing. A lot of money is spent in marketing, particularly in these online schools. That money's got to come from somewhere. It comes from educating kids.
And this actual business reality gets to the heart of questions, arguments, debates, especially in the black community where charters are focused on who controls. For example, you can have groups of activists or parents in a community who say they are going to open up a charter school because they don't like the way the public schools are educating their children, but then turn the operation over to some national stock exchange member corporation to actually run the institution so that it's really not connected to the community except in terms of those who filed for the charter. The actual operation is a corporate one.
That's right, in a lot of cases. And, you know, and the real solution here is for children and parents who don't feel like they're getting the education they need from public schools or from anywhere, is our answer here is to build up a responsive and inclusive, a well-resourced public education system that serves everybody. At this point, there's a lot of charters in this country. So whether they're a charter or not a charter, every kid needs a great education. We need to spend every dollar we have educating kids and not making large corporations profitable.
In terms of these virtual or cyber charter schools, what kind of student body are they designed to serve, and do they really serve them?
We've talked to teachers at California Virtual Academies who like their students, they want to do a good job, and you know what they say is over and over again, you know, an online school is not for everybody. It's not for kids that are having trouble in school, they need more human contact with a teacher. It's for the special cases. Somebody who's training for the Olympics, somebody who is a prodigy, who is just so brilliant, someone who's in TV, or, you know, for the special kids who are really quite motivated and have special circumstances. Now, that's who these things are for. And, you know, one of the things I should also mention is the charter, as the teachers told us, the K-12 Inc.'s charters, you know, really relies on the parents to be the teacher. Because, you know, kids need supervision, and not just supervision. They need help, they need supervision, they need someone to discuss their work with. And if a parent can't provide that role, then that kid's not getting educated.
Defenders of virtual or cyber charter schools say that the benefit is that kids can learn at their own pace. But apparently, with the K-12 schools that you guys have studied, the graduation rates in those virtual classrooms is far below those of the public schools.
That's right, yeah. You know, one couple-year period we looked at, there were more dropouts than graduates from K-12, from CAVA schools around the state. And again, it goes back to this is not for everybody. So one of the things that happens is some young person is not doing well in a public school or in a brick-and-mortar school, as I refer to the other schools. They say, all right, and they sort of get, you know, nudged out. Why don't you try an online school because it's not working for you? And they're not really the right kind of student for that. And so they end up failing because your own pace is fine. But these are children, students of, you know, all different ages, who need support, who need mentoring, who need a lot more than at your own pace. There are exceptional students who are highly motivated and who are brilliant in many ways, or, you know, or have extraordinary specific talents. But that's not most of us. Most of us need adults around and teachers around to help us succeed.
But for K-12 and these other for-profit corporations, each student is simply a unit of a per-pupil funding system.
Right.
In other words, those are monies that are taken from the brick-and-mortar public schools.
That's exactly right. Business model is very clear. They make money when more students are enrolled in their online charter. That's the basic and simplest truth. And so they want more kids in their charters, and they want to spend as little as possible, but still giving some sort of education. So you know, that's the model. What we also found is that in the period we looked at, the CAVA schools in California had received $95 million in public funding from daily attendance. 49% of that went to K-12 Inc. in Virginia. Now, that wasn't all profit, but it wasn't spent in teaching kids. And it certainly wasn't for rent and keeping facilities open, because they didn't do that. That's a lot of money. It's almost $50 million, much of which, not all, because you have to administer, you have to have management and things, but, you know, much of which is being basically taken out of education.
So in a sense, it's just like private medical care. A great deal of the expenditure goes to profit for private firms. The same thing with privatized education.
That's right. Same thing with privatized prisons. It's not rocket science, is sort of what I keep saying of people I talk with. If you want to privatize something, then basically the only way private companies can make money is by, they still call it being efficient, but the only way they can do it is by spending less on something and doing more of something. And so our question is always, what are they spending less on? And the only thing they could be spending less on is the service.
But in the case of virtual or cyber charter schools, it's difficult to organize against them because they don't exist in any specific geographic place. Very little to inspect in terms of the conditions of education because it's all online.
Well, the way to do that, though, there's a few ways you can do that. One is teachers are actually in California Virtual Academies in California are organizing or trying to organize for union representation so they can collectively bargain with K-12 Inc. So that's happening. They want a voice. There are efforts to change the law because the law allows a lot of this stuff to happen. So if we can change the law, and there are people who are concerned about that, advocates and unions and others who are concerned about that, and teachers and parents. And so if we can tighten up the law and tighten up the regulations so some of these really obscene practices don't happen, we might be able to push online education back to the corner where it may be appropriate. And there's efforts to do that.
Well, this is not a movement just to get rid of online education, which has some merit, some potential values, but to break the relationship between private profit and education.
That's exactly right. I can't say it any better. An educated population where everyone is educated, not just the ones who can afford it, that's a public good. That's what makes us able to have a society. So it's fundamental public good. We shouldn't be profiting off of that. We should be spending every dime, every dollar, making sure that happens across the country. Every kid has the full educational opportunities that we can offer.
And in fact, we, the public, are not profiting from it. Those schools are run for profit, or at least for the profit of the educational company providers, but the monies come out of the public pocket.
That's exactly right. And they have a lot of political power. The laws have been set up that allow charters to grow. They're growing very rapidly. And so this is a political fight. It's a righteous public fight so that we have a government and public institutions and services that serve everybody. So we're up against some pretty powerful forces, but I think we can win.
That was Donald Cohen of In the Public Interest.
Most people think that the developing world is short of money and that cash flows from the rich countries of Western Europe and the United States. But the opposite is true. According to James Henry, an expert on global banking, the rich countries are extracting fantastic amounts of cash from the developing world, including from China and Russia. Henry says the flow of money to the rich countries amounts to about $12 trillion a year.
For many developing countries, not only China and Russia, but also much of Latin America, we've noticed long periods in which there was a positive residual, a big surplus flowing out. And when you accumulate all this foreign flow up and take advantage of what we know about the international private banking system, a lot of it is reinvested offshore through secret havens and trusts, and then it's basically reinvested because a lot of the investors, the owners, are public officials or kleptocrats in some cases, but also, you know, just wealthy people trying to protect themselves against political risk. They're reinvesting that money offshore and often back in the first world, but through these anonymous vehicles, so nobody knows it's theirs, not paying much tax on it. And they're investing it at relatively low rates of return. So collectively, it added up to about $12.1 trillion from the developing regions as of 2014. And that's compared with $9 trillion as of 2010. So it's continuing to grow. In fact, we've seen capital flight from China explode in the last 18 months. So the number for China in our estimate is $1.6 trillion invested through offshore entities. Anonymous entities, like we've seen in the Panama Papers recently, but that number is even higher now. So collectively speaking, the world has to worry about this because it means that, oddly enough, the developing world is actually a net creditor of rich countries in the world, at least the Western Europe and the United States that are receiving most of this investment. And when you add up the official reserves, as well as this flight wealth that's offshore, the net loan is on the order of nearly $13 trillion. So it's a tremendous opportunity cost for developing countries.
So we're talking about a big picture that's not one of global investment by what we used to call the First World, but global extraction by the First World from what we used to call the Third World and other developing countries. Well, we also used to call that colonialism.
Well, there's no doubt about it that we have a huge international haven industry composed of big banks and law firms and accounting firms and hedge funds that's, you know, finding this a very profitable source of capital. And there's no question that they have contributed to the supply of secrecy. So, you know, I think a lot of investors who are sitting in Russia or China or Saudi Arabia, which is another big country on our list, are legitimately concerned on a micro level about, you know, do their countries have clear economic futures? Are they strategies? Are they risky places to be invested? So at that level, it's not really a morality play. It's more like, okay, if you were a wealthy Russian, would you keep your money in Russia? Probably not. But the problem is that from the system standpoint, you're absolutely right. Not only are the Western countries basically profiting from this flow, and the, you know, major banks behind the haven industry are especially involved in helping to facilitate this stuff, but it also is basically, from the country standpoint, much more foreign capital that they, missing wealth, I would say, is the way to look at it, that they ought to be able to think about ways of attracting it back home. One of the problems is we've seen the relationship between what I call kleptocracy and this kind of capital flight. If you look at the biggest countries on the list, they're all countries without democratic government, without the rule of law, you know, places where investors are not feeling secure. So they're going to take their money offshore. And so the result is, you know, they end up, oddly enough, relying on institutions that do have the rule of law and countries that do have the rule of law. And that's where they want to put their money. So I think collectively we have a gigantic kind of pathology in the world system. We have developing countries basically supplying capital. This is the opposite of what we'd expect. But it contributes to inequality because, you know, almost all of this offshore wealth is owned by the top 0.1% of the population. You know, small business is not taking advantage of these devices. Ordinary middle class people are not hiding their money in Panama or using offshore companies.
Yes, so, but your point is that the billionaires in the developing world, like the Russian billionaires and the Chinese billionaires, aren't hiding their money in Panama or in the Cayman Islands, that money ultimately goes to the big banks in London and New York.
Well, or it goes to investments, certainly the big asset managers in these places. I mean, the banks share the field with asset managers, with hedge funds, with anyone who's involved in basically receiving money and investing it. But yeah, the role of the 91 offshore havens now that we have, you know, is really to provide conduits and to anonymize this capital. You know, nobody's putting their money in Panama. There is some Panama banking that goes on that you can put assets in Panama that way, but it's relatively small compared with the amount that's just simply using offshore companies and trusts that are provided by places like Panama or BVI or the Cayman Islands, you know, or the 89 other havens around the planet to shelter their wealth from scrutiny. So it's that supply of financial secrecy that we're concerned about. All the funds are really ending up back in the First World, either the U.S. or the U.K. or Switzerland.
To build on what you've talked about, the United States spies upon not only its own citizens, but taps the phones and reads the emails of people all over the world, and yet the equivalent of two-thirds of the U.S. gross domestic product is moving secretly, or secretly in terms of the knowledge of the general public.
Well, I think, supplying secrecy is delivered to the wealthy folks and the kleptocrats by these institutions. At the same time, there's no doubt about it, the United States feels insecure and threatened by, you know, all kinds of international threats, especially, but also at home. And so we do maintain this huge security apparatus. I think that's appropriate at some level. Perhaps we're all concerned about terrorism, but that's a separate discussion here in this corner of the world. There's no doubt that we are oversupplying privacy and secrecy to, people, who are all engaged you know, there are some legitimate uses for offshore havens, but I'd say the overall balance is that this is financial secrecy provided by havens, and the global haven industry is basically facilitating, you know, a lot of harmful activities, not only tax dodging, the kleptocracy that I talked about, but also, you know, arms dealing and drug dealing and the financial chicanery that we saw in the 2008 financial crisis. It's kind of like the Star Wars bar scene where you see all these various kinds of dodgers sitting around using the same basic facilities, which is the less and less expensive financial secrecy provided by havens.
One would think that U.S. administrations presiding over the world's largest economy would be most concerned about these twilight transactions rather than having such a deep interest in corruption in the soccer game.
Yeah, although that's, I mean, that's another kind of activity we've seen, but there are many forms of this. I mean, I'm struck by the fact that we've known about all this for decades and that nothing has been done about it. I mean, we've had expose after expose, like the Panama Papers. That took off in April. Suddenly, the largest single revelation in the world of financial secrets, but sort of 214,000 companies, people and clients in 200 countries. We've identified 28 heads of state who had made use of the Panama companies provided or the facilities of this one law firm to provide companies all over the world. But this is by far the largest leak that's happened, and it sort of complements the studies that we've done on how much wealth is offshore. It pointed to the role of China and Russia as well in the Panama Papers. But my concern is that this is really not a new story. It's by far the largest story ever. But, you know, we've known about this offshore system for decades. And the most recent thing to happen is that the secrecy has really come to move onshore. So you have states like Delaware, Nevada, and Wyoming also have no beneficial ownership registration. So you don't know who owns trusts and companies that are owned there. And increasing number of offshore investors have used Delaware companies to facilitate their investments elsewhere. So this is a gigantic problem, but it's really journalists and whistleblowers that have brought attention to it, and organizations like Tax Justice Network that have been fighting this system. It isn't law enforcement. It isn't the NSA that's revealing all of this activity. It's comparatively a handful of understaffed, hardworking, independent journalists and whistleblowers who are bringing this stuff to light. So, you know, I think it's about time. We know now more than we need to know, really, about the whole system. We need to start cleaning it up. There's a lot of specific things that can be done if we have the political will to do that.
Well, one thing we know is that in the language of the global capitalist, secrecy in terms of financial transactions is a comparative advantage for a state or a country, and therefore, in those terms, a good thing.
Well, that's right. And there's a concept called tax competition, which has been promoted by this industry. That's where one country basically waters down its tax rules, its regulations, and another country will follow suit. And pretty soon you have a race to the bottom like we've had since the 1970s with lower and lower taxes on capital and weaker regulation until the financial crisis. There's been some turnaround now that was recognized as a real issue in the financial regulation, but we're still seeing a race to the bottom in the tax world where multinational companies are pressing for lower and lower corporate tax rates in country after country. So the irony is that this haven system has really been driving the tax rates lower. It isn't the high tax rates driving the haven system. It's just the opposite, really. I think it's just one of the many implications of this is we have to get this unseemly kind of level of tax and regulatory competition among countries. You know, they should be collaborating. We have to get it under control. But, you know, this is a very powerful kind of global industry. Obviously, the clients here that we've identified in the Panama Papers are pretty influential people. And the sheer scale of the wealth at stake here, as we've seen in these numbers, you know, this is just the developing region wealth. We're talking about worldwide. Our latest estimate is at least 24 to 32 trillion offshore for the overall industry, including developed regions. So there's a lot of tax revenue to be gained for, you know, wealthy countries as well, if we just go after this industry, because 2/3 of it is from rich countries.
And if you don't include Delaware and Wyoming and those other U.S. states in the equation, you're really just doing a three-card Monte, pointing over here at Panama and not over there at Delaware.
Well, my first article about the U.S. as a tax haven was in February 1989. You know, the first time I wrote about private banking as a problem with big banks taking money out of developing countries was in 1986. So I would really like to not be able to write about this problem anymore. I'd love to have us do something about it. But the problem is that this industry has enormous influence politically, the big banks and law firms and accounting firms that are engaged in financial secrecy for a living, arranging all these structures. And Putin did not get in touch with the Panama law firm himself or his cronies. They were servicing more than 500 banks around the world in terms of taking orders for offshore companies and trusts, all told more than 14,000 law firms as well were channeling orders. So it's a gigantic global network. The scale of the estimates we've identified, I mean, most of the wealth is pouring out of about 30 countries that account for, you know, 94% of this offshore wealth. And you just go down the list, you see that they're all places that are basically not subject to the rule of law for the most part. And, you know, they've accumulated this offshore wealth over time with the help of this great big industry that we just can't get under control.
Which means that in this country, which I guess you consider to be a democracy, it's not living by the rule of law either.
Well, I think we have been successful in certain things with respect to our form of democracy. We have a long way to go in terms of achieving our country, I think, is the right way to think about it. So, but, you know, I think in comparative terms, if you are a Chinese oligarch and you're thinking about, should I have some investments in California or should I have it in Shanghai, which is overbuilt, the debt ratio to GDP in China is now north of 250%. So a lot of people are saying, my gosh, when we look at the Chinese growth model, it turned out it was all based on the same stuff that was involved in the Big Short over here. You know, a lot of lousy lending and nobody's quite sure where it came from. So they're looking at, should I invest in the United States now or should I invest more money in China? And I think that, you know, that's part of the factor driving this, is the fact that the United States is relatively democratic and relatively clean place to be in terms of having investments.
In other words, there are fewer laws that curtail the behavior of people with money.
Well, yes, I think that there's more predictability in terms of the court system, for example. In China, we've recently seen the government just crack down on wealthy people who they consider to be corrupt. But anybody who became wealthy in 5 years in China is likely to have some skeletons in the closet, so they're going to be nervous about government activity. One measure of this is there a relatively free press in a country? The United States has lots of problems with its media, as you know better than anybody, but we're not throwing a lot of journalists in jail. There are some that are sitting there for being whistleblowers, but I think I'm just talking in comparative terms here. And from that standpoint, investors are looking at the United States and Western European countries as places that offer more protection for their investments. And that includes, you know, kleptocrats who have ripped off their own countries. They can also turn to the Western institutions and this financial secrecy network to get protection. So it's a lot of fault to go around. You know, the United States, I think it's intolerable for us to be providing financial secrecy for at such levels for investors, especially for kleptocrats. We have a lot of cleaning up to do in terms of providing more transparency for companies and trusts would be a good thing, and also cracking down on the enablers of all this activity, people who are facilitating tax dodging. But at the same time, the developing countries have a lot of work to do as well to make their countries more democratic.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.